talking to me? Well, then who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Oh, yeah? Huh? Okay.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles and part two of our discussion of Martin Scorsese's 1976 classic, Taxi Driver. After his failed date with Betsy and his inability to get her on the phone, Travis Bickle decides that his only choice is to confront her face to face. We go back to campaign headquarters, mm-hmm. and we have very similar shot setups. He comes in with this dolly, and then we cut to this his POV as it drives in on them, yeah, and it is now extremely threatening.
Yeah, he's barreling in there.
Let's not have any trouble.
Okay, you're talking about, why won't you talk to me? Why won't you talk to me? Why don't you answer my calls when I call you? You think I don't know you're here?
Let's not have any
trouble.
You think I don't know? Could you please leave?
Put your hands off.
Okay, then leave, okay?
I just want you to know that I know.
No, let's not have any trouble. Please, just leave. This isn't the place to...
And Albert Brooks, you know...
Yeah.
Stands up, tries to take it.
Tries to be the man in the relationship.
And, you know, he does well.
He
does,
like, right.
When a crazy man mm-hmm. like Travis Bickle walks in,
yeah.
that is not an easy guy to stand up to, particularly when he starts to take out and he takes on this karate pose.
That's so great.
He is ready to take him down.
And he's a Marine. A Marine with no hand-to-hand combat. That might have been a move right there. I'm not a Marine, but I know we got trained in hand-to-hand combat
sure.
in the Army, but that may be a hand-to-hand combat stance for a Marine, so I think only a Marine could tell us yesterday.
It was a good karate.
It was scary as shit.
Yeah, and then what he says next is even scarier.
You're in a hell, and you're going to die in a hell like the rest
of them. Come on now, there's a cop across the street.
You're like the rest of them. Look, I'm calling the cops. Officer!
Man.
Yeah.
That is, and Cybill Shepherd taking that in. I mean, this is really scary.
It is, but at no point is she like... necessarily overtly unsettled or scared, right? You sense that this is a dangerous situation, but she's not running behind people and hiding behind people or screaming.
No.
She is unsettled.
I think it's shocking.
That's what I mean. It's shocking more than, and then eventually maybe later she'll be a little more unsettled by it. But this is an interesting moment. And I wonder if he hasn't been calling her, if he's never sent the flowers,
right.
is this shocking to her because she hasn't seen him in weeks and all of a sudden he barrels in with this whole
right.
narrative in his mind that he's created because he's having this psychological break? I don't
yeah.
know.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Albert Brooks gets him outside, threatening to call the cops.
He really does.
And he goes away.
Yeah. I half expected to see Cybill staring out the window at him as he
yeah.
walked by.
Yeah.
Half did.
And he says this really weird thing.
I realize now how much she is just like the others, cold and distant. And many people are like that. Women for sure. They're like a union.
Yeah. Do you know many people online feel this way?
Oh,
about female pundits?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
They're unsettling, these unsettling people. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing about Travis Bickle, is that he's not alone.
Mm-hmm.
There are and you know there are a lot of Travis Bickle out there.
There are a lot of people who take women rejecting them and create a whole thing about it instead of accepting. Hey, that's just not the right person for me. They didn't appreciate me. They take it as an offense.
Just like all the others,
right? It's like all the others. You're rejecting who I am as a person, just yeah. like all the others did.
Yeah,
and yeah, it's an easy trap to fall into.
He ever thought about what Martin Scorsese is like in a cab?
We're about to find out.
Put the meter back. Let the numbers go on. I don't care what I have to pay. I'm not getting out. Put the meter back on. Put it down. Put it. That's right. Put it down. That's right. Why are you writing? Don't write. Put the thing down. Just sit.
So he wasn't supposed to play this part. There was another actor who was going to play it, and he was in some kind of accident.
Oh.
And so Scorsese had to do it at the last minute. I can't imagine anyone else doing this.
It's so great.
He is great yeah. in this scene.
Whenever Scorsese acts, he's very enjoyable.
Yeah.
Quiz Show, he is great in Quiz Show.
Yeah, he is. I haven't seen that in a while. I like that movie.
That's a good movie.
Yeah. He is creepy and funny and smiling. And De Niro's completely non-acting acting.
Yeah.
He's just sitting there and listening in this scene. Again, this is the master class. Mm-hmm. Is watch De Niro
take it in, and the little things he does, and he doesn't mess anything up.
Yeah.
And what we find out is that Scorsese's character has a 44 Magnum on him, and his wife is up in that second story window. We see her silhouetted, and she is with a man that is not him.
Do you see the woman in the window?
Yeah.
You see the woman? So I want you to see that woman, because that's my wife. But that's not my apartment.
And he says some racial slurs about the person who's up there.
Yeah.
And then he says some pretty horrible things about what he's going to do with his 44 Magnum, which I may or may not play.
Probably not.
Yeah, let's say not. They're horrible.
Yeah.
And
but it's an unsettling...
It's really... And he starts to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you really think I'm sick, right? You think I'm sick? You think I'm sick? You don't have to answer. I'm paying for the ride. You don't have to answer.
It is really unsettling.
Well, no, I think, and this is what people need to understand. If you're watching this movie, you're a male and you're watching this movie and you're kind of enjoying these scenes and laughing along with these scenes, this is real. Now, he may be presenting it in a way that's slightly comical, but there are men who legitimately talk this way, feel this way, act this way. Violence towards women is just one second away from them doing it. So it is comical in the scenes because it's Scorsese with his rapid talk and his nutty stuff. But the shit he's saying is just as toxic as anything Bickle has said throughout the entire movie up to this scene. Just as it's even more violent because this is an older guy. This is a guy who's gotten married. This is a guy who seems like he's a businessman. He's got a 3-piece suit. Bickle is still figuring out who the hell he is. He's young. And he's coming out of the military, or coming out of the Marines, coming out of war. And so the parameters are different. And so, but still, what Scorsese is saying, just in this small scene, is very, very ugly. It's very ugly. And it's just unsettling.
Well, and part of understanding the man Travis Bickle is understanding the world that Travis Bickle inhabits.
Right.
And the world that he's inhabited, what have we seen? We've seen that there's common blood on the seats. We've seen this guy in the back of his car is going to do this horrible thing. Mm. We've seen horribleness,
but
that is the world that he exists in.
Yeah.
And so in figuring out, and it goes back to Betsy, to Sybil Shepherd, is he tries to bring her into his world, you know, as dark and seedy. He pretends that he can be in her world, but this is the world that he lives in. So the responses to have to this world, they make sense to him.
Yeah, they really do.
And in fact, he's starting to get to a really dark place. Mm-hmm. And when he gets back with the cabbies in the diner and we start having a conversation, he's even more disconnected until finally he says to Peter Boyle's character, whose name, by the way, is Wizard.
Wizard, yeah.
In the show, hey, can I talk to you? And they go outside. And even as they go outside, there's this weird moment where he mad dogs this African-American guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, stares him down. And it is almost like he's kind of daring him.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, he is... saying, what do you want to do? To just some stranger who's walking by.
There's a real undercurrent, and sometimes a very obvious current, in a number of
deep racism in this film.
A number of the 70s films. Oh, this fear of blackness. This fear.
Absolutely.
Because coming out of the 60s and civil rights, the black communities were starting to feel power in this country, starting to feel representation, starting to feel like they mattered in a way that they hadn't before. It started in the 60s, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, this whole idea that, wait, our voices matter. The older generation that had supported Martin Luther and all that kind of stuff, yes, of course, the church, all that nonviolent, but the younger generation had come along, the Black Panthers, the militants. Yeah. So there was a desire to you're not going to push us around anymore. You're not going to bully us and keep us in these terrible economic situations anymore. This is a racist society. So then there's fear. Right. Then there's fear from the white side that has been so used to running things. All of a sudden, they sense fear in the situation. And so you see it throughout these 70s films. We saw it in French Connection with the way Hackman talks to some of the black criminals there. We see it with Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood, the way he treats some of the black criminals in the movie. So there is an undercurrent here and sometimes an obvious current, as I said, of this kind of racism that was very on the surface in the movies. But, I mean, well, how would I say this? Undercurrent in the movies, but very much on the surface in real life.
Well, and Schrader wanted, the movie was originally going to be far more racist because Schrader, who says that Travis Bickle is unquestionably a racist, is that originally the pimp, Matthew Sport, and all of those guys in the house were going to be African-American.
Wow.
And Scorsese is the one who said, no,
yeah,
we can't. Good. We're not going into that.
Good.
That's not what this movie's about.
Damn right.
And Schrader said he was right.
Yeah,
that's what he made the right choice, and this is better this way. So we go to talk to Wizard, and this is this moment you mentioned before where he's saying,
I just want to go out and you know, like really do something. Taxi life, you mean? Yeah, well, nah, it's, I don't know. I just want to go out. I really want to. I got some bad ideas in my head.
And you can see the thoughts are already going in his head that he is going to kill somebody.
Well, he says, I'm getting these really dark thoughts.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to stop them. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. And what's really interesting, if you watch De Niro, his eyes never make eye contact with Peter Boyle.
Yeah.
They're always somewhere else.
It's because he's ashamed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's my opinion.
I'm not saying. I think it's a whole bunch of stuff. Because
I think he respects Wizard. We've only had a certain amount of scenes, but I think he respects Wizard, which why he dragged. He dragged. It is the one rare moment, Steve, throughout the whole movie where he is the submissive.
He's asking for help.
Yes. Yeah. And it's the rare moment. Yes.
Please help me.
And this is, I think this is what's so, this is the thing that redeems Bickle is that he does want a way out. He just doesn't know how to find it because he's not smart enough. He's not educated enough or self-aware enough to find his way out of this situation. And he's surrounded with people who really don't have the tools to do it either.
No. Well, and Wizard, who is the wise man of the Cavs,
says
this whole speech about, well, you know, whatever you do, that's what you are.
Right.
You know, if you're a lawyer, then you're a lawyer. If you're a taxi driver, then you're a taxi driver. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the speech, he kind of says, so, you know, go out, get drunk, get laid, go do something.
All the stuff he's been doing already that has not worked.
Yeah. And I love De Niro's reaction. When De Niro smiles, by the way, it is kind of magical, particularly in this character of Travis Bickle. Mm-hmm. And this is when he does look in the eye, he's like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. And Wizard's response is, what do you expect? I'm a cab driver. You expect Bertrand Russell? Like, it's great.
By the way, I love this. It just occurred to me now, his character is Wizard. We talked about this whole fantasy beginning with the steam.
Oh,
so this might be all connected here. So,
he is the Merlin. Yeah. He's the failed Merlin of the story. Yeah.
Because he's trying to be a white knight. Yes.
Yeah.
He's trying to be a Bickle is.
Totally holds. And we definitely have princesses who need rescuing from
the dragons. And from the
dragons, And then he drives away, and there's that great camera POV as it pulls away.
Mm-hmm.
Travis is watching Palantine on TV, and this is where he does make his cereal with peach brandy and sugar on it.
That's so weird, man.
Listen, when you got to get the booze in you, you got to get it in you.
I guess.
And I always wonder when he's watching Palantine, what's he thinking? What's going through his head right now?
Well, like maybe he's deciding.
He's already decided to kill him?
Maybe he's decided this is how I can get famous, or this is how I can make a statement, or be noticed, or be seen, or be heard. And I think as much as he wants to find place, he wants to matter. He doesn't feel like he matters. And so no one seems to see him, you know?
And it's so disturbing, by the way, that, you know, 6 years after this, John Hinckley shoots President Reagan to impress Jodie Foster, who's in Taxi Driver.
Right.
And if you look at basically all the presidential assassins, they're all crazy people.
Yeah. And they're all loners.
They're all loners and crazy people.
Yeah.
With apparently three names.
Except for Sirhan Sirhan. Who had two names.
Fair point. But he wasn't president.
But he was a president. That's right. That's right. Fair enough.
But his two names are the same. Drives by the campaign office, and there is this shot of the desk, of Betsy's desk with the sodas, and then a cut to him. And it is, there's something about those two shots cut together that are haunting and disturbing and creepy and powerful and emotional.
Mm-hmm. And he's the shark again, circling.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. And we have to talk about the editor on this film.
Please.
Marcia Lucas. Is that she was in many ways maybe the unsung hero of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And the editing in this film This might be one of my favorite editing I've ever seen.
Wow.
Yeah. And there are two or three other editors whose name is I would have to look up who came in because they ended up having to cut this film in like a month, which is really fast. But it is, there's something about, because the shots are so odd and the way they're put together is so powerful. You know, and all the montage shots and all the kind of just the world of New York and his eyes and how it's a really, really well edited film.
Yeah. Yeah.
And editing is hard to talk about because we don't know what the footage was.
Right. Right.
We actually can't know what most of these choices are, why the shot's there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the shot's there because the camera bobbles right after that moment.
Yeah. Well,
who knows?
Yeah.
Well, it's really beautiful editing. And leaves the campaign offices and he starts driving and he almost runs into Jodie Foster. And there's a big musical sting. And there's a girl with her that he almost hits. And we have to talk about her because she is an actual teenage prostitute.
Oh,
she's 15. And Paul Schrader found her. I don't understand quite how he found her, but he was talking to her and went, oh, my God, this is Iris. And he called up Martin Scorsese. This is after he'd written the script. And he said, I found Iris. And he put her in a hotel room for the night. This all sounds a little weird.
Yes, it does.
And then he calls up Scorsese and says, we have to have Jodie Foster meet this person. And so Jodie Foster's mom brings Jodie to have breakfast with this teenage prostitute. And that is who plays this part in the movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very weird, man.
Yeah, there's some really weird stuff in here.
I think there's a lot of shit that went down in the 70s that no one wants to talk about.
Well, yeah, and then we say, like, you know, let's leave that back there. I don't want to leave the movies.
Yeah, true.
But I want to leave that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's weird. And he follows them, and when he's following Jodie Foster and her friend, and we're hearing...
Loneliness has followed me my whole life, everywhere. Bars and cars, sidewalks, stores, everywhere. There's no escape. And God's a lonely man.
Right.
And God's lonely man. The other interesting thing about that line is that he thinks he's special.
Mm-hmm.
He is the
exactly.
lonely man.
Exactly.
God's lonely man.
And most of these people who slide into this kind of madness do feel this way. Do feel that they're some kind of special because they think they're more aware of it than everyone else.
Yeah. Well, and he sees who all the scum and the filth are and exactly what's wrong with the world.
Right.
Yeah. Back in his apartment, he's now got a Palantine poster on his wall. Yeah. And right below that is I need to get organized, which is the joke he made with Betsy.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to need to get some weapons. So let's go meet Easy Andy.
Traveling salesman.
So Easy Andy this is his first acting job. He's never acted before.
Wow.
He's a buddy of Martin Scorsese's who sounds like they wanted to make a documentary about him. He had been a roadie and a stand-up comic. And even at however old he is, which is probably 30 or something, he had lived a life.
Wow.
It sounds like. And he comes in and Schrader was kind of worried. How the hell is this guy who's never acted before going to hold his own with De Niro? He's great.
He's fantastic.
This scene is so weird.
Yeah.
As they're laying out a .44 Magnum and a .357 or .38 snub nose and all these guns. There is something fascinating about the scene.
Right.
This might be a little too big for practical purposes. In which case, for you, I'd recommend .38 snub nose. Look at that. That's a beautiful little gun. It's nickel-plated, snub nose. Otherwise, the same as a service revolver. That'll stop anything that moves. A Magnum, they use that in Africa for killing elephants.
And he starts to push the drugs and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the other thing that happens is with each gun, he takes this huge .44 Magnum.
Yeah.
That gun is a cannon.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts it down, and we see a top-down shot.
Right.
And then we see each gun goes on this black thing, and each time we cut to it, we cut to a top-down shot. Mm-hmm. And then he gets, I think it's the .38, and he aims out the window. And there's this POV shot of him aiming out the window as he slowly, the camera pans along with his gun hand until he leaves it on this couple with umbrellas.
Mm.
There is something really disturbing about that shot today.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably disturbing in 1976.
Yeah, I think it's on purpose.
But it is disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm starting to figure out that the top-down shots are done at the momentous moments of his life, like...
Turning points.
Yeah, turning points. Yes, getting the job, the date.
The date.
And this moment, and mm-hmm. then of course, and maybe there's another one, but
there's a couple more.
Certainly
coming.
The last one.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So,
and then yeah, as you said, at the end of the scene, once he decides I'm going to buy all the guns,
yeah,
is he said, I love that the Easy Andy goes,
how about dope, grass, ash, coke, mescaline, downers, nebutal, toluol, chloral hydrates. How about uppers, amphetamines?
No, I'm not interested in that stuff.
Crystal meth. I can get you crystal meth. Nitrous oxide. How about that? How about a Cadillac? I get you a brand new Cadillac with the pink slip for $2,000.
this is the guy to know.
Yeah.
And now we go into some hardcore training. He's not doing the drugs. He's not doing the booze anymore. He's eating right. He's working out. And you see that ripped, sinewy De Niro body of 1976. He's holds his hand over the stove. It's not faked. That just looks like a dude holding his hand over the stove.
Well, remember, he's a Marine, so he's about to go into war. So he has to train himself to get into war, just like Charlie Sheen does in Apocalypse Now. Like, he's got to mentally get ready to go and take Charlie down in the forest, or in the jungle. But like,
and we see him firing the gun. They're great shots of the camera moving in. What we should say about Scorsese is all of this is storyboarded. Every single detail he has worked out in advance. He is a prepared, organized, as much as he's crazy and emotional in all sorts of ways, he knows what he's doing, and you can see the construction of these montages are just beautifully done. And again, we have another top down in here where we see all the guns laid out. And then there's this shot, he's in the porn theater again, and he's aiming his fingers, making gun fingers, and aiming it at the screen, and then he's holding his fingers in front of his eyes as he looks at the screen. I don't know what it is about that shot, but that's real to me.
Yeah.
In this way. Like, have you ever done that where you kind of hold your fingers in front of your eyes and.
Oh, sure. Of course.
Like, there's just something that's very human and not staged about that for me. I don't know why.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's something that De Niro or Scorsese just like went, yes, this is, we have to do this.
Yeah.
The idea had been growing in my brain for some time. True force. All the king's men cannot put it back together again.
And we see him. First, he's drawing one gun, then two guns, then the gun in the back. Then he builds this quick draw mechanism. And you're just going like, what is happening? What is all this for? And he's putting this cross into the top of the bullet, which we had to do research on, and that it causes the bullet to do form, so it causes more flesh damage.
Oh, damn.
When it goes into a person.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a campaign event. Palantine's going to speak. Howard Brooks is talking with the mic guy. Again, it's funny. And Travis walks up to this Secret Service guy.
Hey, you're a Secret Service man, aren't you? Huh?
Just waiting for the senator.
You're waiting for the senator?
Oh.
That's a very good answer. Shit. I'm waiting for the sun to shine.
And this scene, this is again where I go, this scene is funny.
Yeah.
It's funny because you...
And unsettling.
Deeply, deeply unsettling.
Yes.
Because Travis is in this place. It seems like he's achieved this place of, I know I'm going to die.
Yeah.
So I don't really care.
Right.
He's got this big sort of, all I can describe is like a shit-eating grin on his face.
Yeah.
And he starts asking him questions and goes, you know, oh, I think I saw some suspicious characters over there.
They were very, very...
suspicious.
Yeah.
And he goes, I think I would want to be a Secret Service guy. And the guy asks his address. And he's really quick at coming up with this completely fake name and address. Gives the wrong number of digits for the zip code.
Yeah.
And then goes,
I was thinking my phone number,
which doesn't make any sense at all. Oh, so funny.
But a lot of people talk about this in police, like cops and detectives, and policemen rather, and detectives. And also Secret Service people talk about this. Like when people are preparing themselves to do this, they test the boundaries of the people that are going to be in that area protecting. Like they like to almost brag about it, that they're going to do it.
Well,
because they want to be noticed.
That's what I mean, I think him wanting to be noticed is as important a motivation as anything.
Yep.
And
that is dangerous of a one.
And then he calls one of the other Secret Service guys over to take a picture of him, and Travis gets the hell out.
Yep.
Do you think that he was thinking about killing the senator in this scene?
Not in this scene. I think he was casing it.
He was casing
it. As a military guy would do.
Yeah.
You survey the landscape. You figure out the battlefield. You know where the ins and outs of that battlefield is so that when you are ready, you'll know what to do. And he cased the security.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening.
Absolutely.
Okay. we have arrived at the most famous scene in the movie. Even people who've never seen this film have seen this scene. Travis Bickle standing in front of a mirror. You talking to me?
You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, then who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Oh, yeah? Huh? Okay.
And what's really funny is this is not my favorite scene in the movie.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I appreciate why it's a famous scene.
Sure, sure.
But I don't understand. I really don't understand why this scene is just so big.
Okay. I don't think it's the best scene in the movie. I agree with you. And I don't think it's that's the reason it stands out. It stands out because there's a kind of subtle badass nature to it. And it's also a moment that all of us relate to where we feel disempowered, for lack of a better term, in certain situations, and you want to fight back, and you want to say, "You're looking at me, hey corporation. You take a You're looking at me, hey person. You're looking at me, hey boss. You're looking at me." Like you want to have that moment of rebellion and strength and pushback from the people who you think are abusing you or not treating you well or doing whatever. And so he has it, but there is what you allude to earlier, Steve. There's that smile, that smirk.
Yeah,
it's the last, like almost last, kind of weird, charming moment for him, because he has that kind of like smile and he's shaking his head and he looks and he's, "Are you talking to me? Are you talking to me?" And so and just the way he delivers it all, I think, is what makes people enjoy the scene so much. The delivery, what's going on, the smile, the smirk, and then the idea of a gun like sliding out of, probably the first time people ever seen something like that, sliding out of his wrist to be used so quickly.
Yeah,
you know, it's unsettling in that way, but it's his performance that makes everybody
he's
love
great.
It. Yeah.
And it's funny, as you were talking, I totally think you're right. And it reminds me, now that you're saying that, in a weird way, with Network, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore."
Right.
There's a similar sort of "fuck you" of this. You can't push me around anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm the little guy standing up. Mm-hmm. That is powerful.
I'm God's lonely man.
God's lonely man. Yeah, wow. God's lonely man. And by the way, of course, this is improv. All that was in the script from Paul Schrader was Travis Bickle stands in front of the mirror. Martin Scorsese is kneeling with headphones on right below him, sort of. And it took 4 or 5 hours to shoot. And it was, you know, De Niro sort of figuring it out as he went along.
Mm-hmm,
And, you know, like I said, among the most famous shots in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go into this really weird thing of him standing there, and we hear his monologue.
"Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore, who would not let..."
And then there's a jump cut, and then it starts over.
Yeah.
"Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up."
That is fully Godard kind of moment.
Well, yeah.
And all of the editors were 100% against it, and they said it's a terrible idea. And Scorsese said, "Yeah, I love this, by the way."
Me too, man.
I don't know what it is. I can't describe it.
I love it because it makes sense. Because he's a human being who is snapping.
Yeah.
So to include his first attempt at a draft of saying his manifesto humanizes him.
Yeah.
Makes us connect to him more. And it makes us understand this guy who's still trying to figure out what the hell he's doing himself as well. It's a small thing, but it's a fucking brilliant thing because it brings us closer to Travis.
Yep.
Whether we want to be or not, because we've all had that moment where we say that speech in front of the mirror, we don't get it right, then we adjust, blah, blah, blah. That's what he's doing, essentially. He's writing to get it
and
right.
And there's something about, "Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads."
Yeah, yeah, you screwheads.
I've never heard the term screwheads as an insult before, but there's something about it that's good.
Yeah,
we take another cab drive through more fire hydrant shooting, and we end up at a market.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Travis goes, it's obvious that he's known at this market, and he walks over to get something, and then the camera stays on him. There's no coverage in this scene.
Yeah.
And we hear a robbery begin.
Right.
And it is handled, it's all in one shot. Travis comes back around, sees a guy robbing the store. He draws his weapon. He says something first. He doesn't shoot the guy in the back.
No.
And the guy turns with his gun, and Travis shoots him.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple things about this. So Scorsese described this scene in the commentary track or something I watched as Travis's first murder.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this was a murder.
Okay.
I mean, just because the guy had a gun and was turning on him.
Sure, but he didn't turn around to shoot at him. How can I say this? We don't know what he was going to do.
Yeah, I don't know.
But Travis didn't give him a chance.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's murder.
And then something really weird happens.
Because if the guy, it's like Greedo and Han Solo. I mean, who shot first? If Han shot first, man, what do you say?
If Han shot first, that's murder. Well, the guy was coming to take him away.
I'm not going to get us killed by Star Wars fans. I'm just saying that in this moment, if he had turned and shot at De Niro first and De Niro shot back, it's not murder. The fact that he says, hey, and he knows he has a gun, so he has the jump on him.
Right.
The guy turns involuntarily, maybe turns with the gun in his hand.
It happens cocked. Very fast.
It really does. Yeah. So much so that he doesn't have a chance to respond to anything. And the guy shoots him.
Yeah. And then things get weirder because he says to the shop owner, I don't have a permit for this gun. And the guy says, don't worry about it. First of all, they're checking to see if he's dead.
Right.
They have no sympathy for this guy on the ground, who we should say is African American.
Right.
And he says,
a lead pipe.
Yeah, and he says, don't worry about it. The shopkeeper comes around with a lead pipe. Travis leaves, and the shopkeeper beats him with the lead pipe and says, I'll take care of it. And we never come back here. We don't know what happened to that guy.
Right.
It is weird.
It is, but the shopkeeper says this happened like 5 times or whatever. Yeah. So he's taking out his anger and frustrations himself.
On this dead robber.
Right, which mirrors, of course, what Travis is planning to do himself. Yeah. Is to take out his anger on the people that he feels have been, in essence, robbing him or hurting him or threatening his life. And so this is it's an uncomfortable microcosm because it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
This is probably New York at that time as well. These people jumping in at a moment's notice to rob you. There probably weren't cops being able to walk around all the time to protect these shop owners. And these people come over and they're just trying to live their lives and do a business and pay their bills. And they're getting threatened all the time by criminals.
Well, and what seems like probably the racism of the shop owner too.
Yeah, sure.
You know, well, he's Latino. We don't know. I mean, we don't really know. But the guy does come out and beat an unconscious or dead guy with a lead pipe.
Yeah.
And then we cut to this weird thing, which is Travis is watching TV and he's watching American Bandstand. And the first thing he sees is an African-American couple. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that's on purpose.
Yep.
You know that. And I don't know what he's thinking, but he is holding his 44 and he is watching these people dance on this TV. And he just killed this black guy in this market.
And he's pointing the gun at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And why it's interesting. One of the shots, one of the couples dancing looks like, what's his face? Looks like Sport with the white hat and the thing behind.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like him. So there's evocative stuff through this shot.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
And now we're going to get two things that are kind of juxtaposed together, which is Palantine making a speech and Travis watching, while at the same time we're hearing a letter he is writing to his parents.
Yeah.
And it is a weird, weird letter.
Yeah. Dear father and mother, July is the month I remember, which brings not only your wedding anniversary, but also Father's Day and Mother's birthday. I'm sorry I can't remember the exact dates, but I hope this card will take care of them all. I'm sorry, again, I cannot send you my address like I promised to last year. But the sensitive nature of my work for the government demands utmost secrecy. I know you will understand.
We are all
I am healthy and well and making lots of money. I have been going with a girl for several months, and I know you would be proud if you could see her. Her name is Betsy, but I can tell you no more than that.
Yeah. Once again, it's all fantasy world.
Yeah. And it's and the card that he's sending to says to a couple of good scouts. There's a lot of weird stuff going on here.
Yeah.
And as he's looking at watching this Palatine speech from his cab, cop tells him to move along. He moves along. And he sends the card off. He says, don't worry about me. One day there'll be a knock on the door and it'll be me.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there'll be a knock on the door and it'll be someone saying I'm dead. That's what I keep thinking.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he plans on being around much longer.
No.
He's watching a soap opera and he has his foot on the TV. And slowly but surely, he's pushing the TV table, the TV's on a little bit further, a little bit further, a little bit further. This is another moment that just seems so true to me. I have done not exactly this, but like this, particularly when I was a kid. Can I break this thing?
Oh, testing the boundaries.
Yeah. What if I light this on fire?
Right.
I was a little bit of a pyro as a kid.
Okay.
You know, I was experimenting with things. And there's something about the sort of, there's no reason to do this. Mm-hmm. This is stupid. What if I do this? And he pushes a little further and a little further. And then it explodes.
I love him.
And then he regrets it.
Right.
Why did I do that? Yeah. That's just real. There's something real about that.
Once again, it's just pushing the boundaries, man. Just trying to figure out where. Yeah, just trying to figure it all out. Yeah. I mean, it's a self-destructive move because he destroys the television.
Yeah, it's his TV.
Which brought him joy.
Yeah.
Or at least a window to the world.
And then he goes to try to see Jodie Foster again.
Yeah.
And he goes up to talk to her. Do you want some action? And she sends him to see Matthew.
Yeah.
And now we get to actually see Harvey Keitel.
He's great, by the way.
He is great.
Yeah.
Scorsese wanted him to play the Albert Brooks character at first.
I could see that, kind of.
Look, Keitel's a great actor.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I want to play the pimp who was supposed to be African-American because he had seen this pimp that was this guy.
Oh, wow.
And he said, I want to do this.
Yeah.
It is a crazy character he's playing.
Mm-hmm. Officer, I swear I'm clean. I'm just waiting here for a friend. You going to bust me for nothing, man?
I'm not a cop.
Then why are you asking me for action?
Because she sent me over.
I suppose that ain't a 38 you've got in your sock.
38?
No.
Huh? I'm clean, man.
Shit, you're a real cowboy.
Then he says, I once had a horse on Coney Island. She got hit by a car.
That's so random, weird shit, man.
What this stuff means. And then we get to the stuff that is really disturbing. Because he says she's 12 and a half and you can do anything you want with her.
Yeah, man.
This is fucked up in 1976. And this is really fucked up today.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is an issue. This is the thing. I've been thinking about this in something as something we're going to have to talk about on the Cinephiles for a long time, which is, should movies present the real world, horrible things included, or should the movies present a world that we aspire to? And at what point are things too real to be in the film? Because child prostitution is real. That really happens.
Sure.
And still happens. Still happening. Today.
Yeah.
And a horrible thing. And there's a sense of like, I don't want Jodie Foster to be playing this part. I don't want to, you know, this is not, we shouldn't be showing this, you know, and yet, and then there's another part. It's like, no, we have to show these things.
Well, look at Natalie Portman in The Professional.
That's a really disturbing
movie. How much was she exposed to at such a young age? And does this affect her?
Right.
Because I hear some pretty, from friends who've worked with her on sets, some pretty insane stories about her behavior. So it's like, okay, how much of that is because, and then Jodie too. Jodie counts Mel Gibson as one of her great friends.
Right.
This is a very unstable person who has had numerous incidences of being violent, verbally abusive, racist, all these kinds of things, yet she always defends him.
Right.
What is it? You know, and so there is being exposed to the harder edges at a younger age, is that, does that damage you or affect you in some way where you think this kind of behavior can be forgiven so easily?
Well, and someone watching this movie in the world and they see a Travis Bickle character, or they see this teenage prostitution, or they see a Harvey Keitel character, and rather than going, oh, that's terrible, they go, oh, I like that. You know?
Oh, right.
You know, that, that because, like, for instance, if you have people smoking in a movie, and listen, I'm going to just say, smoking frequently looks cool in movies.
Yes, of course it does.
And that makes people more likely to smoke.
Right.
So therefore, you don't put smoking in the movie. You know, like this is this weird thing of, are we supposed to be modeling great behavior or are we supposed to show true behavior? You know, and it gets complicated.
It feels like a Patreon discussion.
Oh, maybe this is a good a good discussion for Patreon. So we we'll put a pin in this.
Yeah, we can't get too deep into this one here.
So he goes to talk to Matthew, and Matthew says, okay, it's, he says how much money it is, and I'm going to pay it. And then he goes with Iris to this building, goes into the building, a guy charges him some money for the room.
Creepy fuck.
Yep. And by the way, a lot of the movie was shot in this building. This is one abandoned building that they took over. And so Travis's apartment is in here. Iris's apartment is in here. They built other little things in here. They started tearing apart parts of the building to shoot stuff. They used this building a lot. And we walk into the room. He's reluctant to even walk into that room.
Yeah.
He definitely is uncomfortable. And the first thing he's asking her is, are you really 12 and a half? She doesn't want to answer.
No.
She's kind of... she's kind of all business.
Listen, mister, it's your time. 15 minutes ain't long.
And she wants to get right to business.
Yeah, just to get it over with.
And it is uncomfortable. And by the way, what they did, so Jodie Foster, it wasn't legal for her to do some of the scenes.
I'm sure.
That's her older sister. She has a sister who's 16, who's 6 years older, who's 18. So for anything where it's suggestive, where she's unbuttoning his pants or where she's doing things, those are mostly shots of Jodie Foster's older sister.
Wow.
Yeah. And Jodie wasn't in the room.
Good.
Yeah. Doesn't that make you feel a little bit better about it? He finally gets that her real name is Iris, and she keeps trying to get undressed and do her job, and he keeps saying, don't do that. And he tries to remind her of this night where she got into his cab.
Yeah.
When you remember me? I mean, remember when you got into a taxi? It was a checkered taxi. You got in and that guy Matthew came by and he said he wanted to take you away? He pulled you away?
I don't remember that.
You don't remember any of that?
No.
Well, that's all right. I'm going to get you out of here.
So we better make it or Sport will get mad.
And he has to stop her and stop her. And he says, I want to help you. And she doesn't want his help at the beginning. And it's an interesting thing of going, when she says, I don't remember, I must have been stoned, I don't know if she remembers or not. And when she says, I don't want your help, I don't know what she wants. She is a hard character. Iris is tough to figure out.
Yeah.
And this is part of what we're going to get into, is part of her doesn't want to leave this life. And part of her, I think, really, really does.
Yeah.
What the hell's the matter with you?
Listen, you don't have to make it, mister.
God damn it, don't you want to get out of here? Can't you understand why I came here?
I think I understand. I tried to get into your cab one night, and now you want to come and take me away. Is that it?
Yeah, but don't you want to go?
I can leave anytime I want to.
Well, then what about that one night?
Look, I was stoned. That's why they stopped me. Because when I'm not stoned, I got no place else to go.
Which a lot of people who get into this world feel.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reasons, their parents reject them or don't understand them or just don't speak their language in so many ways and don't have the ability to speak their language in so many ways. And so they rebel and leave, and you know, sex was only the only form of acceptance. A lot of these kids are emotionally and physically abused, sexually abused by their parents, by family members. I've dated three or four women who've been abused by their uncles, their fathers, and brothers.
Numbers, when you see the statistics, are so high.
It's insane.
It's terrifying.
Right.
Well, and then there's also the thing of maybe they would like to go back, but with everything they've been through, they don't know that they would be taken back.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And he says, you know, well, I guess I tried. And she genuinely, I think, says,
hey, look, I understand. And it means something, really.
Like, she actually appreciates that he tried. And then they make a date for breakfast.
Well, this is the thing that's interesting about Travis Bickle, isn't it, brother? His earnest, even if he's clumsy, awkward, or too bold, or too aggressive, he's earnest in a way that's somewhat, how can I say this? Noble, but clumsy.
I agree.
Right? He's noble, but in a way that is not a standard nobility. It's an unsettling nobility or clumsy nobility.
Well, I mean, honestly, he's crazy.
Yes.
But he is trying to do the right thing.
Yes.
And the other thing I think is that I think he is more himself with Iris mm-hmm. than he is with Betsy. I think the person he's presenting with Betsy is much more of a facade
yes.
than he is, particularly when we go to see them at breakfast. Mm-hmm. You know, and by the way, before he goes out, he gives the crumpled $20 bill to the guy for the room.
Yeah.
And there's one shot where he's on a dolly. And so he's just moving, kind of floating down the hallway. And the hallway is really dark. There's a shot kind of looking down the stairs that's mm-hmm. very reminiscent of Kane.
Oh, yeah.
Looking down the stairs with boss Jim Geddes.
Yeah.
And then there's just deep, dark shadows. The guy disappears in the shadows. And what Scorsese says is a lot of this is shot like a horror film.
Yeah.
And this is very much, very horror.
Of course.
And then we go to breakfast. And Jodie Foster in this scene is bright and
yeah.
funny and seems very untouched. She's wearing these funny glasses
mm-hmm.
and she seems very untouched by what's been happening with her.
Yeah.
And you can see
how young she is. Her teeth are still kind of coming in or
yeah.
freckles on her face, all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
The way she's putting jelly on her toast.
So that is something that the actual prostitute that she met, that's what she did when she had breakfast with Jodie Foster.
Oh, really?
That's where that came from. From that. So
brilliant.
And it is a weird moment because she puts sugar on the mm-hmm. jelly. It's a very strange moment. And apparently, so when De Niro met Jodie Foster, he kept taking her aside and go, let's rehearse the scene. They did it over and over wow. and over again. And Jodie Foster said it was a real acting class.
I'm sure.
Like one of her great acting classes. And what they did it so much that then he started to throw out different lines. Mm-hmm. And the lesson she said she learned is that you can only improvise when you know it so well that you're ready to expect anything.
Of course.
And in this scene, there are lots of things. You see her reaction mm-hmm. when she laughs. Like, I don't know who's weirder, you or me. Like, some of those are improvs that are happening within the scene.
That's great.
Are you a narc?
Do I look like a narc?
Yeah.
I am a narc.
God. I don't know who's weirder, you or me.
I don't know who's weirder, you or me. It's so fun and yeah. light and real.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good scene.
But he is very judgmental of her. Like,
hey, I'm not square. You're the one that's square. You're full of shit, man. What are you talking about? You walk out with those fucking creeps and lowlifes and degenerates out on the street and you sell your little pussy for nothing, man? For some lowlife pimp? Stands in a hall? I'm square. You're the one that's square, man. I don't go screw and fuck with a bunch of killers and junkies the way you do. You call that being hip? What world are you from?
And that's the thing, is that Travis has a view of the world that he wants to shove other people into
oh, yeah.
and make them adhere to that may not necessarily be true, but in the end, which we'll talk about, it's a very interesting ending, man. So, but anyway, this scene is just him.
To be clear.
Yeah.
He's right in this. I mean, like, she's 12.
Right, but if her parents...
She should not be doing this.
But if we don't know if her parents were abusing her sexually, so he may be forcing her back into a terrible thing.
Well, and she keeps defending...
Well, she says, I can't go home. They don't understand me, man. They don't care about me, man.
Well, and she says the sport really cares about me.
Yeah.
He really likes me. And Travis says he's the scum of the earth.
Right.
I mean, like, his anger, the most kind of nastiness we see come out of him is mm-hmm. really coming out of him talking about sport.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing is, how many of us haven't been in a situation where we see a female friend of ours or someone we care about in a relationship yep. with a bad guy, and we try to talk them out of it and make them aware of how they're being mistreated? And vice versa. If you have a male friend who's in a bad relationship with a woman who's mistreating them, you try to get them to see what they're doing, the pattern of mistreatment, but you're not going to see it. And a lot of women who get into prostitution at a young age, this is how pimps do it. They remove, it's almost like a cult. They remove your identity so that your only identity is connected to them, And they are the only ones that can make you feel wanted or important in the world.
Well, and that's exactly where we're going next. Yeah. Because Travis is going to be outside in the cab. And this is really the only scene in the movie where we're not with him.
Yeah.
And the way they get around it is they say, oh, he's outside looking in.
Right.
But we're going to see Harvey Keitel and Jodie Foster. And she starts with, I don't like doing this. And it is this seductive, really creepy, upsetting scene to me. Mm-hmm. Where he says, no, baby, if you liked it, then you couldn't be my woman.
Oh, man.
That is fucked up.
Everything he does is psychological warfare on a young child with low self-esteem.
So here's what's weird. This is what Scorsese says about the scene, which I couldn't disagree with more. Yeah. He said, and this scene's not in the script. Harvey Keitel wanted to do this scene. This is his idea. And Scorsese wanted to do this scene to show that Sport really does care about Iris and that he doesn't beat her or hurt her. And I'm like, that is not what this scene is showing me at all.
Not at all.
It sees what you just said. This is psychological warfare to control a child.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's this has come up on the Cinephiles a few times where it's like what the director or the writer thinks is what we're getting. It's not what I'm getting.
No.
This might be the most uncomfortable scene in the whole movie for me. Even more than the violence.
Right, because she starts out by saying she doesn't want to do it anymore. Yeah. And if he really loved her, he'd stop making her do it.
And one weird thing is he puts a record on and he puts the needle on the record. Mm-hmm. And what plays? That same Travis Bernard Herrmann theme.
Yeah.
Apparently, the album came out before the movie came out. And Sport went out and bought it, I guess. It's very strange. Yeah. And then at the end, he ends with him saying,
you know what times like this? I know I am unlucky.
And then they kiss.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Very creepy. This is a 12 and a half year old child.
Yeah.
Right?
And we immediately have a hard cut to him training with a handgun with these jump cuts coming in and these shots of these targets. And it is, we feel the move. Now, it's really propelling us towards something. Mm-hmm. We see he burns the flowers. He's sharpening the knife. He's typing the knife to his boot. He writes a letter to Iris and he sends her the money. He says, dear Iris, this money should be enough for your trip. By the time you read this, I will be dead.
Yeah.
So we're getting there.
What's the point of an iris in a camera?
Ooh, it opens and closes for light. I mean,
okay.
Yeah. Or an iris in your eye. I mean, that's where the term comes from, is from your eye. Yeah. Interesting.
She may be his way out, his light.
Maybe.
Now I see it clearly. My whole life is pointed in one direction. I see that now. There never has been any choice for me.
Valentine's in a crowd. We're back at Columbus Circle. Albert Brooks introduces him. Travis gets out of the cab. We don't see his face yet. We see him through the crowd. Again, no face. He takes a pill, and we see him with that mohawk.
Oh, infamous mohawk.
Yeah. And by the way, it's a bald cap, which I didn't realize.
Oh, really?
He didn't shave his head, but his hair is underneath that. That's a really good one.
That's awesome.
And he looks really creepy. And I love that he's smiling and clapping at the speech. And again, we're in this guy knows he's going to die.
Yeah.
Like, he's just... his life is over. Secret Service is scanning the cloud. The speech ends. Palantine starts to exit. Travis is moving forward. He's smiling. Yeah. He reaches for the gun, and they point to him. They spot him.
So is he reaching for the gun? Why doesn't he use the gun that's in his... so they wouldn't catch that. But why does he reach the gun that's inside? Reaching for the gun, or is he trying to, like, once again, do a dry run and see how close he can get?
I thought he was going to kill him.
Okay. That's fair.
That's what I thought.
I'm sure it's a fair assumption to make, obviously, because he's reaching in.
So. I mean, my assumption is he wants that big 44.
Yeah.
Unless did he leave? He didn't leave the 44. He didn't shoot the guy with the 44 in the market.
No.
I think that was...
no, he leaves the gun.
Yeah.
Because the guy in the market takes the gun.
He takes that gun.
As a self-defense thing, so that Travis doesn't get in trouble.
And anyway, they spot him. They run after him. The Secret Service falls down, and he manages to get away.
Yeah.
And here's the next thing that... so remember I said there's this quote from Schrader that I love.
Oh, yeah.
So the quote started with, the girl he desires, he can't have, and the girl he can have, he can't desire. He fails to shoot the father figure of one and shoots the father figure of the other.
Mm.
Yeah. He wants to make the Madonna into a whore and the whore into a Madonna.
Interesting.
I'm like, whoa, that says a lot about this movie.
Yeah.
Because now he's going to make he's just failed to shoot the father figure of one. So what's he going to do?
He's freaking out in his hotel, in his apartment, rather.
He goes back to his apartment, he takes some pills, and then he heads out back to Keitel. Mm-hmm. Keitel's making some kind of deal in the corner. Travis pulls up in the cab, driving fast, pulls over in sort of a crazy way, walks across the street to Keitel.
Hey, sport, how you doing?
Okay, my man. Where do I know you from, man?
Because it's obvious something weird's going on.
Yeah.
And one of the things that De Niro, I think, does better than anybody else is the pause. Is he's not answering in the correct rhythm.
No, you're right.
It's really weird and awkward in this. Yeah. Do I know you?
Do I know you? How's Iris? You know Iris.
No, you know I don't Iris. Know nobody named Iris. Iris, come on, get out of here, man.
You don't know anybody by the name of Iris?
I don't know nobody named Iris.
And then Keitel flicks a cigarette at him.
Yeah.
Kicks him in this weird way.
Yeah, because he's something about, oh, you got a gun? He says, you got a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then pulls out a gun and says, suck on this, and shoots him in the belly.
Yeah, man.
And suck on this was in the script. And and Scorsese and De Niro just loved suck on this. But then it's De Niro's idea that rather than going straight into the building, that he walks over and sits on the stoop.
I love that moment, Steve.
There's some about it.
It's very real.
It's real.
He's like the black guy he kills in the convenience store is a spur of the moment thing. This is planned out. Yep. Therefore, there's more responsibility here in his mind. So when he shoots him, he has finally made a decisive
in this moment
a decision of what to do with his life. He has made a proactive decision, spending the whole movie pondering what to do. He has finally done a proactive decision straight up that he planned out, shoots him, sits on the stoop to kind of take a moment to understand of what he's doing and if he's going to keep going. And if he's going to, so I think in that moment he's contemplating, I can stop right here. I can stop right here, get in the cab, get the fuck out. No one's going to know.
Yep.
And then I think, I have to finish this.
He goes into the building.
Yeah, man.
And this action sequence, first of all, is really, really hard to cut.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Really hard to cut. Very hard to shoot. All the editors worked on it until finally they still couldn't get it. Mm-hmm. And who comes in to help finish editing this scene? Steven Spielberg. Spielberg comes in to help.
Spielberg?
Edit this. Yep.
Spielbergo? Yep. I don't believe it, man.
That's the legend.
Mr. Disney?
Yeah.
Mr. Feelgood?
This is not his kind of movie, but you know what? He's a great craftsman. Well, he understands film. First guy comes in, which is the guy that brought him to the room. Mm-hmm. He shoots his hand off, or shoots a bunch of fingers off his hand. It is a brutal shot. And I have to talk, because the makeup guy, whose name I don't remember off the top of my head, is fantastic. And he described how you do these things. Is like, for this, if there was more room, if you're not in a narrow hallway, you would attach like fishing lines to the fingers and you would pull them off.
Right.
But they couldn't do that because there was nowhere to get close to it. So they had to build a whole device, build a squib into a wax hand and actually blow the fingers off of this guy whose hand is down in his sleeve.
Jesus Christ.
And then Travis gets...
He's shot in the neck.
Yeah, he gets shot in the neck next.
Because Keitel
came in. They had to build
a
completely new mechanism for the blood, because it keeps bleeding out of the neck. And then, of course, what you have to do, whenever you're dealing with things like blood, is you always have to match it. So you're constantly shooting Polaroids to see how much blood is out at this moment so that you can pull out a shirt. Oh, now that shirt has too much blood on it. We need a blood with only shirt with only 8 inches of blood. And who shot him in the neck? It's Keitel. And he shoots him again.
Right.
Yeah. And we also see upstairs, Iris is hearing these gunshots.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he shoots, because he's angry, he shoots Keitel twice to make sure he's dead.
Yep.
Then the old guy with the, he's still there.
Still up the stairs.
Yeah, shoots him.
Shoots him.
And then the guy still comes up the stairs screaming at him like, you son of a bitch, son of a bitch.
Well, and that's when he gets shot in the arm.
Right.
And he turns around and shoots this guy in the face.
And the guy we see who shoots him in the arm is the same guy who's just talked and gotten money from Keitel. And we see the guy had a gun because he pulls his suit. The side of his suit jacket back to put the money back in, and you see the gun. So in my mind, I thought he was an undercover cop who was using this pimp to have sex with these underage girls because he's a sick fuck, which happens sometimes.
Sure.
Some of these police guys are that way, so criminals too. Like, it's just there, the seedy underbelly.
Sick fucks are everywhere.
Yeah, sick fucks everywhere.
Not in the cinephiles.
No. Then the old guy's still clamoring
still
to him.
Still coming.
Yeah.
He shoots this guy in the face, and the way they do that is they have little blood pockets built up around his face connected with... fishing line that are going off in different directions. And apparently the guy gets all rigged up, which takes like 3 hours, and he's got little fishing line taped to his face, and his girlfriend comes up and goes, oh, you got a hair out of place, and reaches up and grab one and starts to pull it, and they go, no.
Oh my God.
Stop her in time, because what they're doing is guys off camera pull these things.
Yeah.
And that makes the face wiggle, and then the blood come out. I just love practical effects. They're kind of fascinating. They're really smart people to figure out how to do them.
It's incredible.
And then that guy is still coming after him, charges up the stairs as Travis gets to Iris's room, tackles him.
Yeah.
And he pulls out that knife that he had in his boot, drives it through his hand.
Crucifies him almost.
And basically, and that one is with a, it's a knife with a retractable blade.
Right.
It goes on one shot. And then we cut to the shot of the blade coming out of his hand.
Yeah.
And Jody's yelling, don't shoot him, don't shoot him. Travis shoots him.
Mm-hmm.
And then what does he do? He takes the gun.
Shoots himself.
Tries to shoot himself.
Yeah.
Click.
Yeah.
Click.
He was going to kill himself.
Well, and this goes to like this why watching this movie today, you know, in 1976, there hadn't been all of these mass shootings where people kill a whole bunch of people
right.
and then kill themselves.
Right.
That hadn't happened yet. Now this happens all the time.
Mm.
I mean, it was tragically. And one of the things that this is a slight digression or is that one of the things they've talked about in terms of why are we having so many of these mass shootings is this idea of copycats. Once you see that such a thing is possible, then that's in your mind as a thing that you could do. And there's like there's this famous study and thing that happened in Indonesia. There was this rash of suicides in the 80s. They became very publicized. And that more and more people started committing suicide, which they had never done before. And when they stopped broadcasting the news of suicides, then the suicide rate went down.
Wow.
Because people stopped seeing it. And I think about Travis Bickle, and then I think about what's happened in the world today. And I'm not blaming what's happening in the world today on Travis Bickle.
But no, but I would blame them. I would absolutely blame newscasts and media for sensationalizing this kind of stuff. Absolutely.
Because if you are the Travis Bickle of today, you are disenfranchised, mm-hmm. you're lonely, mm-hmm. you're having mental health problems, maybe you've had terrible experiences in your youth and you're going, what do I do?
Right.
And you see constantly this barrage of people going into a place with automatic weapons and then killing mm-hmm. themselves or being killed by police.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I'm supposed to do, right. you know? And of course, that's what happens the next moment. And this shot, I think this might be the most intense shot of the film.
Mm.
The police come in slow motion and Travis Bickle raises his bloody finger to his head and pulls the trigger, you know, gun finger. Yeah.
I love that sound.
It's amazing. And we should say, by the way, the sound design in this movie is fantastic.
It really is.
Unbelievable sound design. And the sound designer went on the next movie he did after this is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which also has unbelievably great sound.
Maybe they met on the set.
Kind of different movie.
That's kind of a different The blood-soaked fingers are everything, though, dude, man. Such a great touch.
And then the next shot is, I think, one you were referencing before, is we have this top-down shot looking down at the scene in slow motion as it moves out.
Yep.
So a couple things about this shot. The first thing is they had been prepping for this for weeks. And what they did, because they're in this abandoned building, is they literally cut through the ceiling. They cut through structural beams.
Wow.
And so the building is starting to fall down because of them destroying it in order to get this shot. And then because of the child labor laws, they had gone over. So they're running out of time. And to shoot this scene with Jodie Foster, they only had 20 minutes.
Wow.
They shot this in 20 minutes.
Holy shit.
Buildings falling down around them. Jodie Foster has to go. And it is a remarkable shot.
Yeah.
As it moves out, we go down the stairs, we see the results, we see the guns, we see the bodies, we see the blood. We go outside in this world that's where the police and press and people are surrounding to looking at this moment. It is a very slow exit from a very horrific scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie goes in a direction that is so surprising. I remember when I saw it the first time and I went, what?
Yeah.
Which is that he's a hero.
It's a fairy tale ending.
Yep.
To this fairy tale.
Kinda.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's newspaper articles about this hero taxi driver. And we hear this letter from Iris's parents.
It's such a sweet letter.
Thanking him. It is really sweet that she's back home. And
then we see Iris's parents, but they're like super old.
Yeah.
They're not like in their 40s. No. They're people in their 60s
and
almost.
They're clearly people of, you know, simple people.
Yes.
And they write a really nice...
It's a sweet letter, man.
Letter to him.
I almost got emotional listening to that.
Yeah.
Because the guy says, we can't afford to come to New York anymore. But if you ever find yourself in Pittsburgh, you'll be more than a welcome guest in our home. It's very sweet.
They thank him. And then And then we're back to the cabbies, and there's Travis,
right,
looking okay, and he's hanging out with Peter Boyle and the other guys.
They're still calling him killer, which is so weird.
It's weird. Yeah. And they say, you got a fare, and he gets in his cab, and he starts driving away, and he's kind of looking in the mirror, and we hear that great Bernard Herrmann saxophone, and we hear, hello, Travis.
Yeah.
And there in the mirror is Betsy.
Betsy.
Beautiful shot of her in the rearview mirror. And what's so interesting is they have a really nice conversation.
Yes, but a conversation where Travis is in power.
Yeah.
For the first time ever. He's peaceful. He's almost calm, He's got the upper hand in a way in the situation.
He doesn't want anything from her.
No.
He's not trying to get her. He's not angry at her. He's just like, no. She asks about what happened because she read about it in the papers, of course. He's like, oh, that's not a big deal.
He's very magnanimous.
Yeah.
You know, the papers, they make these things bigger than they actually are.
And then he lets her out.
Yeah. It drives her home, right?
Drives her home. She gets out.
Yeah.
She walks around the driver's side window. Mm-hmm. There's a pause. Almost as if she expects more from him.
Yes. Like, yes.
I think she would have continued this in some way. And she says, what do I owe you, finally? And he drives away.
Well, he puts the thing down. He says, don't worry about it.
He drives away.
Yeah.
And then we have... And we kind of go like, oh, he's okay. I guess Travis is okay. How odd. And then there's this moment where there's this musical sting, which I'll tell you about in a second.
Yeah.
And he jerks his head.
You see the red on his face, the red light on his face.
Red light on his face. And then that's the last we're going to see of Travis Bickle.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have just really beautiful shots of the streets of New York.
Yeah.
As we hear this music.
Mm-hmm.
So first let me tell you about the musical sting, and then we can talk about what this means. So Bernard Herrmann recorded he said, you know, they said, we want one more sting for this moment. Bernard Herrmann recorded it, and Scorsese didn't like it. Oof. And said, yeah, I don't really, it's not intense enough. It's too normal. And Herrmann, who sounds like he was pretty gruff, said, just play it backwards. And that is what it is. It's that musical sting played backwards. You can hear it's played backwards. And that is the last piece of music Bernard Herrmann ever recorded, that sting. What do you think it means?
I fucking love this moment. And I'm sorry to cuss so hard. But,
it's Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
But
these genuine moments, these like brilliantly artistic moments in film that are quick, to me, are gold. They're diamonds. They're treasures. Because in the right hands of a right filmmaker, they mean so much. Which is, this whole fairy tale ending, is it real? Is it not real? I don't know. The letters, I don't know if any of that is real, right? Let's say it is real. And everything worked out, right? He's back driving a cab again. God knows why he's driving a cab again. He killed a gangster, an Italian gangster. And apparently nobody wants revenge on him for it, which is an insane stretch of the imagination to think that's believable. And then he gets in the cab, and she knows exactly which cab to get in. Interesting. Sits in the cab, drives. He's all in Paris, very comfortable, he's calm. He's the guy who's like in charge. Then... when you think he's this noble knight, he's gone through his hell, his like trial by fire, and he's come out the other side. And that flash shows you that evil Bickle is still in there. And that's what that is to me. It shows me that no matter how sweet or normal he is, there is that underbelly of anger at the world that will never go away. And it's schizophrenic. It's almost schizophrenic, an illusion. Because he has this other side of him that is darker and more violent and more angry that will always be below this, bubbling below the surface. No matter how sweet of a hero he's turned out to be, because he wasn't heroic necessarily.
No.
And so the papers may have turned him into a hero, but he knows who he really is.
Well, I don't know if he knows who he really is, but I totally agree. That moment is to say, no, he's still Travis Bickle.
Uh-huh.
Nothing's changed. Uh-huh. He might be having a moment of stability and control and calm, but that's just the calm before the storm. He is who he is.
And I just wonder if the studio said to Scorsese, you got to put a happy ending on this thing. And he's like, oh, I'll give you a fucking happy ending. But I don't know. A little bit something too.
It's a good question.
It would have been great. Question.
No, it's an interesting... It's a very unsettling place to end that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not knowable. We don't really get to know.
Yeah. And I never, ever want to see Taxi Driver 2. I never, ever want to see sequel Travis Bickle De Niro doing Travis Bickle now at like 70 years old.
No.
Because I'm sure they've come with ideas for a Taxi Driver 2.
And I'm sure there's been a briefcase full of money.
Two or three.
Do you happen to have final thoughts on Taxi Driver?
Yeah, I would just say this. If you haven't visited this movie in a while, maybe you've been afraid to see it, maybe like me, maybe even nervous to kind of walk back into this world. If you've gotten on a little bit older in years from the last time you saw it, I would encourage you to watch it again, especially in light of where our world is now and the things that we've seen and experienced and the changes that have happened in the world. You might find yourself uncomfortably understanding Bickle a little bit more than you did before, and finding some compassion for him while still maintaining the belief that what he did was wrong and shouldn't have done the things that he did. But I think the film also is an incredible exploration of the uncomfortable things that we may feel at times and don't act on them, but we certainly think them sometimes and are afraid to explore the darker sides of our nature. And I think that's what this film really does for you. It allows you to explore it without you having to actually explore it within yourself. Right. And that's the mark of a great movie.
I think one of the things that Travis does is he divides the world up in a very black and white way.
Mm.
He sees it as, you know, as you said at the very beginning, this is knights in shining armor, yeah, and wizards and dragons and evil and good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all have a tendency to do that. We hear about a certain behavior,
right,
or we hear about a certain person that does a certain kind of thing, and we go, oh, well, that person's evil.
Yeah.
And I think that is a dangerous fiction, mm-hmm, to walk around with. And I think it's good, not all the time, but some of the time, to go into a movie that forces you to look at things in a way that you didn't look at them before.
Mm-hmm.
It forces you to look at the world through the eyes of someone like Travis Bickle and actually sympathize with this person,
yeah,
who is not actually, who's a person that's kind of scary,
mm-hmm,
you know, and yet we're kind of with them and kind of enjoy them, mm-hmm, even when we're watching them do some things that are pretty despicable.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that helps us to see the world in a different way, in a more nuanced way, in a more sympathetic way, and maybe in a way that will help us to solve some of these problems. Because really, as we see in the world, as we talked about with mass shootings,
yeah,
this isn't going away.
Yeah.
And we're not gonna solve any of it by going, oh, those are bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the point. That doesn't help us. We got to understand what is making a person go into a room and do a thing like that. And this movie made in 1976, before they had the term PTSD, before all these mass shootings, I mean, there had been a couple of mass shootings, but not
right,
many.
Right.
Before all that was happening, man, it seems like it has some deep insight into the way the mind works. And what's interesting to me about it is the only way they get deep insight is if Paul Schrader and Robert De Niro and Martin Scorsese had been there,
yeah,
to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have the insight unless you've been there.
It's too truthful, too real.
It's too real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's what we think about Taxi Driver. As always, we definitely want to hear what you think. You can visit us on our Facebook page at The Cinephiles. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, on YouTube, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, on Spotify. You can leave reviews or comments at a whole bunch of those places. We love reading them. They really help us on iTunes. They help us on Spotify. They're fun to look at on YouTube.
Yeah.
We really enjoy them. If you want to suggest a film, you can go on patreon.com, just like Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
We got a whole bunch of films coming up that came from our Patreon subscribers. We really appreciate them. That's patreon.com/thecinephiles. If you haven't seen Taxi Driver yet and you want to buy it, the 40th anniversary Blu-ray is really, really good, and it's available for purchase on our website at cinephiles.net, as are every movie we've ever reviewed. And if you want to reach out to me, you can find me at SR Morris on Twitter. John, where can they find you?
They could find me not buying the 40th anniversary of this film. Although now, having seen it this morning, I think I might buy it, actually, jokingly enough, like, because I might want to see watch the behind the scenes and the special features.
There's a lot of good stuff on it.
Oh, that's I'm going to buy it then. And I will actually go through our link.
Because if you do that, yeah, we will make like 17 cents. And we will split that,
yeah, well,
evenly.
Thank
I don't
you.
Know who gets the half penny. We'll figure it out.
That's fine. I'll get some chuckles with it. But okay. You guys can always find me at The Roca Says on Twitter and on Instagram. And this has been an enjoyable episode for me to do, because this was a film I was so, so dreading.
Yeah.
And to have it turn out in such a positive way, an enjoyable way, was a lot of fun. So,
Well, I'm glad you had fun, and I hope that everyone listening had fun. Yes. I definitely had fun. And that is it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.